Accession number 29424, reel 9.
Paul Oestreicher, reel 9.
My most interesting experience with East German state security came through my close relationship with Dr. Zaidowski on the one hand, and prominent East German dissidents on the other. Zaidowski had always said to me, if some of my friends are in trouble with the East German authorities, and I really feel they need help, he could give that help because he had enough power. And he was true to his word, and on several occasions he helped people either to immigrate or in other ways. He proved to me, in other words, that he had the influence he claimed to have. Well, towards the end of the communist system, I think we're now talking about 1987 or thereabouts, he came to London to see me, as he did from time to time. I should have mentioned in my earlier talking about Dr. Zaidowski that this very senior Stasi official had a public role which had nothing to do with Stasi. He had a perfect cover. He was the head of East German Television's Foreign Relations Department. So he travelled around the world buying films and so on for East German Television, buying and selling films. So he would turn up in London quite frequently to come to see me for a conversation. He always invited me to Brown's Hotel in London. He prided himself on this very traditional English hotel. And, well, he came, and this was his last visit to me, actually, before communism collapsed. And this time he said to me, this is the first time ever I've asked a favour of you. You've asked several favours of me, and I've been able to fulfil your wishes. This time it's me that wants you to do us a favour. You know, as I know from my information, he would say, that the Popper family, Ulrike and Gerd, are very prominent dissidents in our state, and they really get on our nerves. Now, I know that you have helped several other dissidents to immigrate to Britain. And, as it were, they wished to leave the GDR. And with the help of the church and so on, you've given them sanctuary. That's one of the things I did do. Well, the Poppers really are getting on our nerves a bit too much. Would you be kind enough and invite them to Britain so they could leave the GDR? I can assure you we will give them visas, exit visas, immediately. They will have no difficulty in leaving the GDR. If you'd be kind enough to invite them and they accept your invitation. Now, that was a very, very, very difficult assignment, because actually to fulfill his wish was to take out of the dissident scene very important people. And that would really be serving the East German government in a way I would not wish to do. But with hindsight, I'm almost half ashamed of myself. Perhaps I should have blankly refused. But I said to him, I know the Poppers well enough to be pretty sure that if I issue that invitation, they will turn it down. They don't want to leave the GDR, they want to reform it. And they would feel traitors if they left. So I can safely invite them and do as you ask me. But I can tell you now, it won't work. But of course I was taking a gamble. Well, I agreed to do it. I phoned them up and I said to Gerd Popper on the telephone, Gerd, I have a very important message for you, not the kind of message that I would want to convey on a telephone. It's really too important for that. I'll come to Berlin at the next weekend, and I'll tell you why I've come. And he rang back, and he said, okay, I've discussed this with Ulrike, my wife. We will meet you at the Café of the German State Opera in the Unter den Linden, quite the most public place in Berlin you could imagine. On a lovely summer afternoon, it was high summer, it was June or July, and we will meet at 3:30 in the afternoon, next Friday afternoon, and if you come flying to Berlin in the morning, we'll be waiting for you at the café, at the Opera Café. And his wife actually worked in the German Historical Museum across the road. All she had to do was come from where she worked to meet me. I turned up, as I said I would, and sitting at a table were the two paupers, just as I expected. But the amazing thing was, sitting two tables away was Zadowski. In other words, our conversation had been overheard, which we knew. We knew their phone was bugged. So those phone conversations were, of course, quite public in a sense. We knew the state was listening, but all I was doing was what the state asked me to do anyway. So there was no point in keeping this secret. But Zadowski chose to be there, two tables away. Now, that did surprise me. So I went to the paupers immediately and said, here I am, but hold on a minute. I'm going to talk to the chap two tables away before I come and talk to you. I'll be back in a minute. So I went to Zadowski's table and I said, Hans, what are you doing here? And he played an incredible sort of game. He said, Paul, how amazing to meet you here today. What are you doing here? And I said, Hans, you know perfectly well. I'm just doing what you asked me to do. And he said, I thought it was the paupers then. As though he didn't know. As though he was there by pure chance. You know, it was an extraordinary game that he played. And said, yes, Hans, these are the paupers, and I'm about to fulfill my mission that you asked me to. See you. So I went to their table. And he actually got up and walked away then. And told them. Well, in my naivete, I expected them to laugh and say, you must be joking. We wouldn't leave this place. You've obviously been asked to invite us. I didn't make any secret of this. I said, you know, I've been asked to invite you to England and they'd like to get rid of you. So as far as I'm concerned, if you really want to come to England, you're welcome. But I made plain that I really didn't expect them to say yes. And I thought they would say no there and then and the matter would be settled. But to my somewhat horror, I said, are you really saying you're inviting us to England and we could come with our children and you'd make sure we were all right in the West? And having gone that far, I had no choice but to say yes. If you want to leave this country, that's your free choice. And I wouldn't stop you. But I felt very uncomfortable about it. And they said, well, we need time to think about this. Will you still be in Berlin tomorrow? And I said, well, yes, I can stay over the weekend. Well, come and see us tomorrow in our house, and we'll give you a definitive answer. Well, the next 24 hours was very uncomfortable for me. I came to their house, and I found them in a state of considerable gloom. And they said, you've really thrown us into a panic. Let us tell you the truth. We've been so worn down by the treatment we've had from the state, constant threat of arrest, constant surveillance. We're really at the end of our nervous tether. And we have been talking to each other about leaving. And here you suddenly come with this offer. So we've agonized for the last 24 hours. And the answer is no. And I was so relieved. It's the answer I wanted, of course. And so the matter was settled. I'd done what Sadovsky asked, and it had worked out exactly the way I'd predicted. What I didn't realize is how hard the decision would be for them. And that was my mistake and my naivete, if you like. And the aftermath was that after the collapse of communism, Gerd Popper sent me an extract from his Stasi file, which he had, of course, by then had the privilege of reading. Indeed, by then, he was the human rights, I don't know what the formal German word was, the human rights officer of the West German, of the unified German government, and an MP, and a Social Democrat MP, which he still is. Their marriage is broken up, but he's a German MP now in the Social Democratic Party and was their sort of human rights expert. And he read his Stasi file. And there he found these photographs of me being observed by the Stasi coming to talk to the Poppers. And I'm described in their report as Kranz, which is the German word for a wreath. Don't know why they called me that. Maybe my bald head or something, I don't know. Kranz talks to, and then the two Poppers are each given code names, a photograph of me talking to them. Then Kranz gets up and talks to a person unknown, two tables away, and another photograph of me and Sadovsky. Then Kranz returns to talk to the Poppers. All this in the Stasi report. In other words, the Stasi officers did not know who Sadovsky was. In other words, the lower ranks didn't know that this was a high-up Stasi man sitting two tables away.
What was his reaction to that? You know, how did he regard you, Popper, because of that?
Well, he knew me so well, and he's a very, very cunning guy. He never referred back to it, even when we met later. I think his only reference was to the Poppers after the collapse of communism when I used to meet him. One day he said, "I'm sorry to hear your good friends, the Poppers, have split up." That was his... It's only a reference to that whole story, and clearly he didn't want to talk about it.
How about Gerd Popper, though? Having seen in the that you were called, Kranz, in the, and seen that photograph.
The Poppers.
Was he suspecting?
Yes, the Poppers. The Poppers. After the collapse of communism, wanted to know the whole story about me and Sadovsky. And it took them quite a while to accept that I wasn't a Stasi agent myself. You know, it took them quite a lot of taking in. I mean, in fact, my friendship with her now is that's a part of the different story. Ulrike Popper was in prison together with Barbara later. And we're very close friends with her, but I've lost contact with him. I mean, no particular reason why I should lose contact with him. I could get in touch with him any time, and I'm sure he'd be quite friendly. But she was quite suspicious for a long time. What game were you really playing? And, you know, we're such good friends now that she totally accepts.
I can imagine there was all sorts of embarrassments and problems with the opening of the Stars.
Absolutely. It led to so many enmities, so many misunderstandings. The Stasi succeeded in dividing people from each other in the most terrible ways. And they did use people as informers and didn't tell them they were using them. So that people have been accused of being Stasi agents and they never knew they were. You know, the most terrible things have happened as a result of opening those files. I mean, other countries in Eastern Europe haven't done that. They haven't opened their files because they said we'll be murdering each other. Well, that hasn't happened in East Germany. I know no case of a Stasi revelation leading to a physical assault or a murder, but it's led to a lot of alienation.
But was that the only case that caused you trouble? That the Poppers, you know...
The Poppers were the only... No, they were not the only case where I was resented by dissidents for, as they saw it, cooperating too much with the authorities. As I mentioned to you before, I enabled a number of dissidents to come to Britain. Now, three of those dissidents were in prison, and I negotiated their release from prison with the Stasi. Or rather, I negotiated their release from prison with an East German lawyer who, only after the collapse of communism, turned out to be a Stasi agent. But I had no reason to believe he was a Stasi agent at the time. He was their lawyer representing their interests. And I had no reason to suspect him as a Stasi agent. But I used him to get them out of prison at the request of the Bishop of Berlin. It's the bishop that invited me to do this. And all of them wanted to stay in the GDR. All three. I mean, they were in that sense like the Poppers. They saw their role in being dissidents and building a better GDR. Now, they were threatened with a sentence of 4 to 5 years. And the East German authorities that I negotiated with through this lawyer agreed to what the bishop suggested would be a good compromise. Let them out of prison, and they will come to the United Kingdom for 12 months on study leave. That's sort of a kind of, that was what it would be officially called, at the invitation of the church, with GDR passports and the right of return. They agreed to that. In other words, to be out of the scene for a year, provided they had the right to come back and were not exiled to West Germany, which is what the communists did with many others. They simply exiled them to West Germany with no permission to return. And I negotiated their permission to return to get them off 4 or 5 years in prison. Now, with hindsight, they learned that this was a trick on the part of the communists, because the documents were discovered, that they threatened them with 4 to 5 years in prison, but had no intention of actually doing that because they thought that would give them too bad publicity. They would have let them out. But they weren't to know that. And I wasn't to know that. But they themselves, with hindsight, said, I was colluding with the state to get rid of them for a year. When, in fact, they would have been released anyway. But I didn't know, and they didn't know, and they agreed, they freely agreed. I mean, they were not, you know, they could have opted to say, okay, if necessary, we'll take this prison sentence on us, but they didn't. So although, you know, they were tricked by the state, they say, and I was complicit in the trick. And two of them were very angry with me. A third one was much more, much less, and you know, was much more friendly. So yes, I mean, you know, you can do the thing with all the right motives, and still be misunderstood in the process.
Is this the case that the Observer highlighted? They wrote an article about it.
Yes, I think there was a story in the Observer.
Well, yes, there must have been a bit very worrying at the time. Was it, Paul? Did you find it worrying? The, you know, despite, as you say, your innocence and good intentions on this, the impression it could have given.
Yes, and a much later, I mean, this Observer article, I think, goes way back, and I've always had a fairly thick skin. I think it's my childhood experiences that have given me a thick skin, and I'm used to being, you know, I think I always deliberately took risks. I think life is about taking risks. So, frankly, a bit of adverse publicity never really fazed me very badly. I mean, that's illustrated, too, by the fact that when I was vetoed as Bishop of Wellington, I got lots of letters of sort of condolence, of people being sorry for me, saying, you must, with all this publicity about being blackboard, I mean, not, you know, it's the publicity that must have really made you miserable. And I always said, what they did made me miserable for their sake, the way they mucked up their own diocese, but the publicity I couldn't have cared less about. I've never been very sensitive about public criticism.
I suppose it's knowing what, you know, what, that you did it.
Yeah. So the public didn't worry me, that you mentioned. I was pretty angry eventually by the stupid book about the Stasi that this guy Glees has written, which is so inaccurate that it's really funny. Glees has conspiracy theories and thinks that anybody who talked to the GDR is a potential idiot and semi-criminal. And the book is full of people maligned, much more than me. I mean, I come off fairly lightly in that book called The Stasi Files. But I mean, he is such a bad researcher that he didn't even bother to read my file. He quoted things about me from other people's files, and put 2 and 5 together, making 77. You know, any critical reader, and all the reviews have been scathing of the book, all the serious reviews. But of course, it's a book on the market. It's the only book on the market about the subject. So people are free to quote it. And the guy's a professor of political science, you know. So it's there. It's there out in the world, and you know, I just shrug my shoulders and say, "Well, so what?"
Probably most people know now that the Stasi agents had to write something, and there was a lot of invention anyway. So
yeah. So all in all, you know, Barbara came off worse than I did in that whole episode.
Because I understand you managed to get the lady who's now your wife. You helped to get her out of the hands of the Stasi.
Well, that's the story of our marriage.
Yes.
If she hadn't been locked up by the Stasi, we would have never got to know each other.
Which is amazing, because you have so much in common in right way back to New Zealand.
I'll give you there's a story. The whole story was told in the alumni journal of the university we both went to in New Zealand.
Gave me a copy.
You've got a copy of that. You've got that. You've got that. Yeah, right.
Yes.
I mean, that's. So I can say, we both say jocularly, thank God for the Stasi. We have our marriage to thank for the Stasi. You know, it's a joke, but a sick, slightly sick joke.
Yes, you know, you've said earlier, I think, that your whole approach has been diplomacy, really, and that compromise.
Well, it's not my whole approach.
Oh, come that's, on then. Let's have your whole approach.
I mean, that's of course the tightrope that my life has been about. On the one hand, I studied politics, and I think I learnt by studying politics that people who are not prepared to make compromises cannot get engaged in politics. Politics is about the art of the possible in every situation. And certainly the willingness to talk to people whom you disapprove of. If you can't make politics if you only talk to the people you like. You can have a pure image of yourself, but you can't achieve anything. So the readiness to talk to your opponents is what politics is about. Now, to that degree, you're right. I have always been a diplomat.
Diplomat with a dog collar. Is that
a diplomat? With, certainly a diplomat, although I rarely wear it. The symbolism is okay. An ecclesiastical diplomat. And my theology, of course, makes that easier in the sense that my belief about human beings is that God loves them all equally, the good, the bad, and the indifferent. And most of us come into all three categories. I can recognize the evil in myself, thank God. And I know I need forgiveness, and so I've got to forgive others. So in that sense, my theology helps my diplomacy. In other words, helps me, as I did with the Bader Meinhof gang and so on, to take people whom I dislike and still respect them. But the other side of me, the side that made me become chairman of Amnesty International and work for the release of political prisoners, is the side that is not prepared to compromise on lots of issues. The side that speaks the truth to power, even when you don't achieve anything, because you feel there are certain things you've got to say, whether that you know will meet with disapproval, and you've got to take that upon yourself. And that led to the fact that even though I wanted to work for a better future in Eastern Europe and in South Africa, in the end, I got to the situation where the Soviet Union refused me visas, where Czechoslovakia refused me visas, where South Africa refused me visas. In other words, they didn't see me as a diplomat, but they saw me as a critic. And even, as the files show in both cases, as a dangerous critic. That's the other side of me. And these two sides of me, of course, sometimes were at war with each other inside me. You know, where do you speak the truth that you've recognized, even if you know that speaking it will put you offside and you'll be stymied? And then you even have to revert sometimes to subterfuge and become, as it were, a public enemy. And that is why, both in the case of Czechoslovakia and in the case of South Africa, I actually reverted to illegality to get into those societies. I subverted the immigration procedure in both cases and went to see dissidents in both cases and, of course, risked expulsion. In the Czech case, I was expelled. In the South African case, I wasn't expelled because the British government, in the end, took me under their wing.
Yes, I know you gave me details.
Yes, that's right.
That is a very interesting example.
But that shows
how far you will go.
That compromise always has its limits.
Yes.
And if I was a total diplomat, lots of things that I have done I would not have done. And if I was a total human rights campaigner, I would never have done the diplomatic things at all. And I can, you know, share that. For example, my friend Michael Bordeaux, do you know who I mean? The founder of Keston College.
Oh, yes.
Keston College was really the organization that documented all the deprivation of religious liberty in communist countries. Mm-hmm. Centre of the Study of Religion and Communism, it was called.
Yes.
It was very academic, but it was its sole purpose was, as it were, to show up the evils of religious persecution in communist countries. Yes. And Michael was completely, straight. That was his sole function. And he and I clashed. He was on my committee at the British Council of Churches, and I said, look, Michael, in this inveterate anti-communist stance, you're playing into the hands of the worst kind of cold warriors. And yet I respected his position because a major part of me was on his side.
But not the whole of you.
But not the whole of me, that's right. I was a complex person.
Mm.
And he was a simple person.
Mm.
Now, it's just me. Mm. I'm just like that. I mean, this is now a personality, this is my background, which impels me at one level to be prophetic and controversial.